listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
Last week, Iran's Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif seized the stage at the Munich Security Conference for nearly 40 minutes, during which time he trashed the Trump administration, fired a pointed demand at Europe to do more to protect the nuclear deal, and generally painted a portrait of Tehran's worldview that is rarely heard in U.S. and Western media. And we bring you as much of it as we can fit into our allotted time. This is Iran's Foreign Minister, Mohammad Javad Zarif.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, and a very good morning to all of you. It's great to be back here. This past Monday, millions of Iranians gathered for mass rallies to mark the 40th anniversary of the Islamic Revolution, an earthquake that collapsed a pillar of U.S. dominance in West Asia. We've never been forgiven by the United States for having exercised our right to self-determination. As a result, we have long been the target of an unhealthy fixation, let's say an obsession, which continues to this very day. The demonization of my country has been a convenient cross for 7 consecutive American presidents to bear, and even a more convenient smokescreen for America's regional clients to hide behind. It is long overdue for the United States to dismantle this malign institution, for it has today morphed into one of the greatest threats, even to America's own security and interests, let alone peace and security in the rest of the world and the region. In the past 2 years, the U.S. has taken its animus towards Iran to a new extreme, as epitomized by its unlawful and unilateral abrogation of its commitments under the painstakingly negotiated Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, which was unanimously endorsed by a Security Council resolution, a Security Council of which the United States is a permanent member. To gain, in fact, accomplices in its lawlessness, the US is now laboring to force others to violate that very resolution, which explicitly calls for normalization of economic relations with Iran. At the recent meeting of, let me just call it, the unwilling and the openly coerced in Warsaw, the US Vice President and the Secretary of State both blasted Europe on European soil for even attempting, albeit without much success, to abide by its obligations under the JCPOA and under Security Council Resolution 2231. Yesterday, right here in Munich, Mr. Pence repeated this farce when he arrogantly demanded that Europe must join the United States in undermining its own security and breaking its obligations. His hateful accusations against Iran, including his ignorant allegation of anti-Semitism against the heirs of a man described as Messiah in the Holy Torah for saving the Jews, is both ridiculous, but at the same time, very, very dangerous. This malign obsession with Iran is imposing costs on others, and especially in our region, which has for 40 years suffered from the consequences of insistence of the United States on making wrong choices. Driven by its pathological obsession with Iran, America has long encouraged recklessness and destructive adventurism on the parts of its clients. Let me remind you a bit of history. From arming Saddam Hussein, many people want to forget. We never do. From arming Saddam Hussein in his attack against Iran, including the use of chemical weapons, to supporting the propagation of extremism, just listen to what Crown Prince MBS has said, from aiding and abetting the ruining of Syria and bombing the innocent in Yemen, to whitewashing the incarceration of a prime minister and the dismemberment of a journalist. In parallel, the US has systematically shielded Israel's constant aggression against the Palestinian people while insulating its severe violations of the sovereignty of Lebanon and Syria. And all in the name of containing Iran. Ladies and gentlemen, the US claims, and unfortunately some blindly parrot, that it is Iran which is interfering in the region. But has it ever been asked whose region? Whose region? Just glimpse at a map for a second. The US military has traveled 10,000 kilometers to dot all our borders with its bases. There is a joke that it is Iran's fault that put itself in the middle of all US bases. Meanwhile, it has milked the region of its resources through massive arms sales. According to the most conservative estimate, the GCC's military spending alone will reach a record high of $100 billion this year. Seven times, listen to me, seven times that of Iran's. So who is really exporting insecurity to our region? What is it that threatens the region more? The unfathomable arsenal used to terrorize the people of Yemen? Or Iran's defensive missiles, which have only ever been used against ISIS in self-defense? Is it Iran that threatens the annihilation of others? Or is it Mr. Netanyahu, the wolf crier in chief, who openly threatens my country's obliteration while standing next to his nuclear weapon factory? No theatrics here, including the show put on by Mr. Pence yesterday, can obscure these realities. Indeed, more and more nations are becoming explicit about the fact that the United States is now the single biggest source of destabilization in our neighborhood. As we speak, Iraqi lawmakers are demanding the withdrawal of U.S. forces from their land. And after more than 18 years of failure in Afghanistan, the United States is now negotiating with the Taliban to withdraw American forces from Afghanistan. In contrast, our standing with the people of Iraq and Syria to counter terrorism has put ISIS on the verge of extinction, with both countries enjoying levels of peace and stability not seen in years. I arrived here from Sochi, where President Rouhani continued his dialogue with his Russian and Turkish counterparts on how further to promote peace in Syria. Prior to that, I visited Iraq and Lebanon, not for a few hours, but for 7 days of discussions with government officials, as well as with political, community, and business leaders on how to work together to strengthen stability and advance economic opportunity in our region. But the reckless U.S. obsession with Iran is threatening even these hard-won victories. On another front, Iran's continued full implementation of the JCPOA, despite U.S. abrogation, has played a major role in decreasing tension and promoting regional stability. But, my friends, Iran cannot foot the entire bill for vital global security achievements, whether it is the nuclear accord or the combating of drugs and human trafficking from our region to Europe. Europe needs to invest as well. Many around the world, including particularly on this continent, speak eloquently about multilateralism, but they also need to walk the walk. For instance, INSTEX falls short of the commitments by the E3 to save the nuclear deal. Europe needs to be willing to get wet if it wants to swim against the dangerous tide of U.S. unilateralism. While we have shown our desire for engagement, we don't depend on others for our security, stability, prosperity, or progress. That is, we solely depend on our own people. That is why 40 years of so-called maximum pressure, namely demonization, war, terror, including the heinous foreign-sponsored terrorist bombing in my country on Wednesday, has failed to bring Iran to its knees, nor has it changed our people's decision-making calculus. And I can assure you, it will never change. Distinguished friends, Iran's foreign policy is designed to further the goal of creating a strong region that precludes the emergence of hegemonic aspirations by any power, inside or outside the region. A strong region simply means, doesn't mean people have to leave our region, it simply means that more confidence, more trade, and more interaction between and among the countries in the region than with the external powers. It requires homegrown political and territorial stability, reliance on the populace as the source of legitimacy, security, and prosperity, harmonization of our national identities with a regional citizenship, participation of all of us in the Persian Gulf region in ensuring peace and the exercising of strategic self-restraint, what we have been doing for a very, very long time. Distinguished friends, in spite of all the ignorant hate speech by American officials, let me remind you that we Iranians are proud to be inheritors of a great civilization. The entirety of humanity, from our perspective, is today riding in the same boat. And we will either sail together or sink together. Our renowned poet Sa'di testified to this truth 900 years ago when he said, "All human beings are members of one frame, since all at first from the same essence came. When time afflicts one limb with pain, the other limbs cannot at rest remain." Thank you for your attention.
Let me begin by asking you, you described the United States' attitude towards Iran as a pathological obsession and that it wanted to bring Iran to its knees. There are conflicting signals. What do you think the goal of President Trump's administration is? To bring you back to the negotiating table or to somehow resolve this with some military engagement?
Well, if they wanted to negotiate, we were at the negotiating table. And they were at the negotiating table. Up until, I think, April of last year, Mr. Brian Hook, who is now targeting Iran here and there, spoke to my deputy in the JCPOA Joint Commission in Vienna. So they decided to leave the negotiating table. We didn't leave the negotiating table. We are still at the negotiating table with the rest of P5 plus 1, which is now P4 plus 1 or E3 plus 2. So we're there. I think we hear conflicting signals. President Trump says one thing. Secretary Pompeo puts 12 conditions for Iranian for negotiations with Iran, which means surrender. And I think he should be dreaming.
But he has held out the hand. He said, you know, gave a compliment to President Rouhani, saying, "I imagine he's a very interesting man that he would like."
No, he didn't say interesting man. He's a lovely man.
And lovely.
But I don't know
offered,
at what time of the day
new,
he said that.
He's
morning,
new,
afternoon.
He's offered a new set of.
No, he didn't. You see, we negotiated not a two-page document and a photo op. We negotiated a 150-page document. Every detail is spelled out. I can assure you, as somebody who negotiated it, and you can ask John Kerry or any of the European foreign ministers who negotiated the deal, or Federica Mogherini or Cathy Ashton, nothing can be done that is better than this deal. It's not all we want, and certainly not all the United States want, but it is the best that could be achieved between six world powers plus EU and another country which is proud to stand on its own feet.
Some of your colleagues have made it clear that once America pulls out of the deal, it's going to be very hard to keep the deal alive because of the mounting economic pressure at home, which, as you know, is also creating more political pressure at home. How much longer can the deal survive?
Well, I'm not a fortune teller, so I don't know.
You said yourself your patience is limited.
It is limited because, as I said in my statement, we derive our security from our people. So it is very important for us to keep the people satisfied with what we're doing.
But they're not.
Now, we're not.
And it's not just because of sanctions. It's because it's primarily because of corruption, economic policies.
All of that. Yes. All of that. We're not saying that we're a perfect country. We're better than most of your allies, but we are still have a long way to go. But what is happening in our region and what is happening in Iran requires a great deal of foresight, a great deal of strategic patience. And we are exercising that. It doesn't mean that we will have to do it forever. Whenever our people are dissatisfied, now the polls are at about 51%. We are just at the brink. 51% of the people believe that we still should be in JCPOA, while 80% of the people believe that we didn't get anything from it.
And your hardline critics who've never trusted this deal, including, I would believe, your supreme leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, the pressure is mounting on those who negotiated the deal to say, right, let's go back, let's start enriching.
Yeah, there is pressure by a part of the population, but as I said, according to the latest poll by University of Maryland, still 51% say we should stay in the deal. That may change. Situations may change. We believe it is in our interest, but we believe it is at the same time in the interest of Europe to stay in the deal. And that is why I believe we appreciate that Europe has done a great deal politically. It has made all the right political statements. Some of them we don't agree with, but on JCPOA at least we can agree on JCPOA. But it hasn't been prepared to make an investment. It hasn't been prepared to pay a price.
Let me ask you a question, as Europe.
If you allow the United States to make these demands, because the U.S. is demanding Europe to violate international law. It's not demanding Europe to abide by international law, but it's demanding Europe to violate Security Council, and it's punishing Europe for implementing it. So this is an outrageous demand. If the United States were to come in the course of their fight with China and told Europe, stop dealing with China, what would you do? Well, whatever you want to do then, do now, in order to prevent that eventuality, because a bully will get bullier if you succumb.
Well, let's put aside the JCPOA, because there's a fundamental disagreement between the United States and Europe on it. But there are issues on which they have shared concerns. Let's look at ballistic missiles. We heard from the French foreign minister on Friday saying we are in a difficult dialogue with Iran, and if we do not see more progress on France, as you know, has suggested a separate deal agreement on ballistic missiles. He said if we don't make progress, France will have to impose new sanctions.
Does Iran have
to address those concerns if it wants to make wider progress?
Let me ask you a question.
I asked you one first.
No.
Yes.
I'll answer your question. Does Iran have to simply lie dead because some people don't want us to be able to defend ourselves?
The UN Security Council resolution behind the Iran nuclear deal called on Iran not to develop ballistic missiles.
No.
My friend,
I negotiated 2231, so yes. I know every word of it. It called upon Iran. It didn't demand Iran.
It did not, call on Iran, yes.
Not to develop, so it's something different, not to develop ballistic missiles that are designed to be capable. Every word of it took months to negotiate. Designed to be capable to carry nuclear weapons. We don't design any of our missiles to be capable to carry nuclear weapons because we don't have nuclear weapons. So none of the Security Council nonsense. The Europeans know it, the Russians know it, even the Americans know it. The Americans have testified before Congress when the deal was on that it's not about missiles per se. It's about missiles designed to carry nuclear, to be capable of carrying nuclear weapons.
Just what
weapons.
They're saying now.
We negotiated forever. But let's wait a second. Problem is, there are $100 billion of weapons going to Iran. Nobody is selling us a single fighter jet. Nobody. How are we supposed to defend ourselves? When we were attacked by French Exocet missiles, by German chemical weapons, by Russian MiG fighters, by British tanks, by American AWACS surveillance, who came to our assistance? When our people were being showered with missiles, with Iraqi missiles, nobody gave us a means of defense, either air defense or missiles to retaliate. No one. We had to beg. Now, I am not going for the pleasure of my friend, Minister Le Drian, or anybody else to make our people defenseless so that the next Saddam Hussein in our region could rise up and kill our people without the means of our defense. We still have people who cannot breathe in Iran because of the chemical weapons that were provided to Iraq from Europe. If we were to negotiate about armaments, Europe has a lot to respond to. Europe is not going to be in the Inquisition seat. Europe will be asked why it supported Saddam Hussein.
Okay,
why
we can't go back into
the bombing in
Let's
Yemen.
Not go back in history. We've got enough on the current. Let's ask this. So the United States objected to your recent, has to be said, failed satellite launches, saying the technology used could be interchangeable with technology used in ballistic missiles.
Then a reporter, argument about missiles is misplaced.
Yes, but then
satellite launches.
The New York Times published a report saying that actually there's been a very long-standing and an accelerated program to sabotage your development of ballistic missiles, providing faulty parts, etc. Iran is looking into this. Is there, do you think, now?
We're investigating this, but I think more than Iran, the international community should be concerned, because last time the United States engaged in that operation, it resulted with Israel in the killing of 6 nuclear scientists. I think it is important for the international community to rise up and say that this is not jungle. We don't run the law of the jungle.
Okay.
That you interfere in the legitimate defense of another country. I ask you a question. Does Iran have the right to defend itself? And if we have the right to defend ourselves, do we do it with swords? Do we do it with whatever, guns? Or do we need sophisticated means of defense? The most sophisticated means of warfare are being sold to our region, and President Trump conveniently calls them beautiful military equipment. Now, we're not getting any of those beautiful military equipment, the beautiful military equipment the Yemenis are getting. Mm. They're being killed with it.
Okay.
I don't think they call it beautiful.
Missiles is one issue. We don't have a lot of time. I just want at least to touch on some of the issues that both Europe and the United States agree on. Last month, the Europeans...
They're simply repeating the American claims. Why they agree on? I mean, this is...
But they wouldn't do it for the sake of doing it. They obviously have concerns.
Any European should tell me. Because, you know, this didn't come out of the blue. We had these discussions during the JCPOA. And we decided, because each one of us had something to say, we decided to set it aside.
Okay,
it's not that somebody has all the right and somebody is just doing mischief in our region.
Okay, let's set that one for the side.
Last month,
European Union, it will unfortunately be negotiated on this for many months, if not years to come. European Union imposed new sanctions on Iran last month. It put 2 Iranians on its list, as well as an intelligence unit, after there were attacks in Denmark, in France, and the Netherlands. So the European leaders are saying, what is Iran doing it, trying to carry out assassinations on European soil? They also see this as part of a kind of behavior that they want to stop.
Well,
they've imposed sanctions, so it's not simply just allegations. And people have been arrested in France.
Sanctions based on allegations, not sanctions based on facts. Let me make a couple of comments, because this is very important, and I want to really address this. First of all, the arrest of the person who is charged with the Willpan bombing happened on the day of arrival of our president in Europe after many months of preparation. Do you think we're really crazy that we do this on the day? At least we do it the day before, the day after, 10 days after, wouldn't die. We do it on the day that our president comes here. I mean, give us some credit.
Some accusations
now,
that perhaps
see.
It was a Hold rogue,
Hold
a rogue operation within
it must,
Iranian
it,
agency?
It could be a false flag operation. It could have been an entrapment. It could have been a rogue operation. But it's certainly not the work of a government that you should call crazy if we did it. And you don't gain the influence that we have by being simply crazy. Now, let me address another issue. There are allegations. Now, the Netherlands made allegations. They kicked out 2 of my diplomats. career foreign ministry officials, and now their intelligence is saying that they had no evidence. No evidence. Now, we are the aggrieved party. Second point. What is clear is that there are people in Europe who have been on Europe's terrorism list up until 2012. What happened all of a sudden that they were withdrawn from the terrorism list? You see, I followed these issues for a long time. In 1984, let me take you back a bit in history. In 1984...
It's an unfortunate date to use, but let's...
Yeah. The United States removed...
Hold on.
The United States removed Saddam Hussein from its terrorism list and put Iran on terrorism list. Again, in 1990, Saddam Hussein was put back on the terrorism list.
We cannot keep going back to Saddam Hussein.
In 1998, the United States put MEK on the terrorism list. In 2012, they took it off the terrorism list. This is a game. This game needs to stop. A terrorist is a terrorist is a terrorist. Terrorists don't change. Rudy Giuliani yesterday spoke for the MEK. John Bolton has spoken for the MEK. John Bolton is angry because he promised the MEK that he would celebrate in 2019 in Iran with them. They are still in Paris.
Do you think John Bolton represents what some say, that a lot of the statements of President Trump's administration verge on wanting regime change?
I think the United States administration is not doing anything but regime change. Regime change. It wouldn't have withdrawn from JCPOA the way it withdrew from JCPOA had it not had the illusion that there would be regime change within a month.
Let's look.
The United States, this administration is listening to wrong folks. These guys have had the illusion that Iran will evaporate for the past 40 years. And we are still here. Seven administrations have gone, and we are still here. And I think we will be here for a long time.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. Is America ready for a real anti-war candidate? Clearly, the political establishment and media aren't. Criticism of presidential candidate Tulsi Gabbard and anyone else who questions foreign policy orthodoxies is swift and unrelenting. Fighting for peace has never been so difficult. Crosstalking the politics of anti-war, I'm joined by my guest, Daniel Faraci in Washington. He's the CEO of Grassroots Political Consulting. Also in Washington, we have Thomas Pauling. He is an independent economist and author. And in Percival, we cross to Philip Giraldi. He's a former CIA counterterrorism specialist who is now executive director of the Council for the National Interest. All right, gentlemen, Crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump in anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Philip, let me go to you first in Percival. I guess it took the advent of the election of Donald Trump for the neocons to invade both major political parties and basically take capture of the media, because saying anything against war, foreign interventions, forced regime change, it's almost turned into criminalized speech. Anyone that stands up, and you know, we had these people in 2003 saying it would be a walk in the park in Iraq. We all thought they were discredited, but they're back with a vengeance, almost like a stranglehold. And it does concern me very much that there's a chilling effect on expressing your First Amendment rights. Go ahead, Philip.
Yeah, I absolutely have to agree with you. I mean, this is the atmosphere is very reminiscent of 2001 through 2003, just after 9/11. It's the media is completely on board of this. I mean, the coverage of what's going on in Venezuela is a disgrace. And there are numerous indications, particularly coming out of the recent Warsaw conference, that the United States is gathering together its few remaining allies to move to a military option against Iran. So this is it's pervasive. The media is not questioning any of the premises that this war talk is based on. And the Republican and Democratic Party are basically on board of it, too. So it's frightening, and that's why it's interesting to see some anti-war talk actually emerging.
Yeah. Let me go to Thomas in Washington. I mean, when Donald Trump announced that the U.S. troops would be withdrawing from Syria, I was astounded on how the media took charge, and they looked for public figures to back up their narrative that Trump is giving a Christmas present to Putin, discrediting America's a position in the Middle East, abandoning the Kurds, abandoning Israel here. I mean, this is exactly what Donald Trump tried to articulate during the campaign, coming through, and he's keeping up with his promises here. I have plenty of criticisms of his foreign policy, but I agree with that. The war in Afghanistan is a failure. It's time to bring troops home. Every single clear-thinking person that knows anything about Afghanistan knows that here. But the media, because it's Donald Trump, they just want to do the opposite. Am I correct in saying that?
Peter, everything you say is correct, and it is truly crazy that Donald Trump should be the fulcrum of all that is going on. That he should be the person who is sort of one third right on these issues, and that he should be the person who somehow manages to surface the reality of the Washington establishment. You've got to realize the neocons have actually been in power now for 25 years. And people need to understand what neocon means. It's a word that's thrown around that people don't. It means that never again will there be a country like the former Soviet Union that can challenge the United States anywhere. At least that's the definition I work with. And it's a frightening thing because the United States now thinks that it can show up on anywhere in the world, the South China Sea, the Ukraine border, anywhere it wants, place troops and change things. It's doing that right now in Venezuela. It wants to get its hands on the oil there. It's been put Venezuela under sanctions now for 10 years and now blames the collapse of the economy on Maduro. And then the media goes along with that and reports none of these stories. And of course, more than that, it's also deeply embedded in the Democratic Party. This is something that has been camouflaged and we're in denial about. The Democrats, a lot of them voted for the Iraq War. They were on board for the Libya regime change. They were on board for the illegal entry into the Syrian civil war. The Democrats have supported the military. It has 800 bases around the world in over 70 countries. And none of this gets reported or talked about or what it says about ourselves. And it's strange that Donald Trump should be the person who is catalyzing some recognition of this.
You know, it's very interesting, Daniel. You know, we could catalog for hours on this program the catastrophes that these neocons have brought upon the world and cost the American taxpayer. It's almost impossible even to imagine the amounts of money that have been wasted. But, you know, they've all been failures. I tend to think, you know, if you kind of look at the past, it is a kind of a guide to the future. Their plans will fail again, but they might. But see, there's a kicker to this one here. They'll fail under Trump's administration. So you have the double whammy right there. OK, you want to undermine the president's foreign policy by doing the opposite and by promoting those programs and those ideas. They fail and he thus has to take ownership of it. Good analysis or not, Daniel?
Well, I'd say this has been a systemic problem since the Carter administration and the Greenbelt concept that he and Brzezinski came up with. But we have, I'd say, on this topic, a systemic problem as well as a generational divide. So it's part positive and negative. The systemic problem is our system was never set up for members of Congress to be able to promote legislation in favor of neocon ideology and the defense apparatus in order to get not just contributions, but a future lobbying job a defense contractor. That is the heart and soul of the problem of why this is promulgated to the 800 bases in 70 countries and allowing every president to have their war. And over the last 20 years, completely disregarding the War Powers Act and allowing even the current conflict from Afghanistan to Syria to wherever else to be based upon a 17-year-old war on terror declaration, not a declaration of war against the country. So that's the systemic issue. Now, I'd say for the electorate and for at least some semblance of anti-war talk to be able to be had in this country, the baby boomer generation that is more neocon and will put on those yellow ribbons and raise the flag anytime we attack brown people, thank goodness they are becoming more marginalized to about 36 to 40% of the electorate, whereas the largest voting bloc, the millennials, this is the positive side of the equation, are much more on Tulsi Gabbard's side.
Yep.
And so I think over, it's going to take a while, but over the course of years, we will get there to where all of this is coming to question. And I believe there will be positive changes. But in the meantime, President Trump, to the establishment on both sides of the aisle, continue to play to the voters that they expect to show up, being the baby boomer neocon generation, both sides of the aisle, and this will just continue, as well as that systemic problem that we have in Congress.
We'll talk about the generational change in a minute. I want to go back to Philip here. Another perversity in all of this is the congressional move to have the United States withdraw its efforts in supporting the torturous, genocidal war on Yemen. But a lot of people are in Congress are doing that to actually make Trump veto it. I mean, they're playing with this devastated country's fate here for petty politics at home. I mean, the magnitude of that catastrophe is almost completely unknown on the American public. But for members of Congress, it's just it's a political ploy. Go ahead, Philip.
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, this is essentially a characteristic of how the Democrats are playing their game against Donald Trump. They essentially are saying that we are opposing Donald Trump's policy in support of Saudi Arabia for good humanistic reasons. But of course, that's not the case at all. They could care less about that, as they have evidenced in Syria and in Libya and in terms of their bellicosity towards Iran. So they don't care about that. They're just scoring against Trump in hopes that this will embarrass him. And so we see this playing out constantly. And the fact is that what's lost in the game here is what are the interests of the American people? The American people, opinion polls seem to indicate, are tired of the constant wars that have been going on for the past 20 years. But until Tulsi Gabbard surfaced recently, they didn't have anybody who was kind of a spokesman for that. And of course, there are very powerful and well-financed interests who believe that continuing with the war economy and with the war policy is very much their interest.
You know, Thomas, thinking about Tulsi, I mean,
Peter, jump in.
Go ahead.
Well, Peter, I think we've got a short-term and a structural long-term problem. The short-term problem is how Trump plays into this. The neocons have got both sides of the table covered. So right now, the Democrats want to get rid of Trump, and they want to make Trump the issue. They get rid of him, and then we finesse having a debate about the real issue, which is our war, our permanent war setting. We finesse having a debate about globalization. We make Trump the issue, and then the policies continue the next presidency. That's the short-term problem. Now, the long-term problem is, I think some of the other participants have already alluded to, is the basic structure of our politics, which is money, money, money. That way, Congress cannot stand up to the money of the war lobby and the health lobby and the many other lobbies that are out there, because you need money to win. If you go and you have an incentive to take it, and if you say no to them, they promise to obliterate you by funding an opponent of yours.
Yeah.
And then you dig deeper into our system. You've got all these fake think tanks. You know, the Atlantic Council, the German Marshall Fund. They're putting out fake policy analysis, fake national security analysis. That then gets picked up by the media that treats these people as authentic. You know.
Okay, I'm going to jump in here. But I've been on the receiving end of those people. Okay, we're going to go to a short break, gentlemen. After that short break, we'll continue our discussion on the politics of anti-war. Stay with our team.
You're listening to Weekday World
on CPR.
Okay, let me go back to Daniel in Washington. You know, one of the interesting, I really like what you brought up about the what the millennials think about foreign policy. And I think you're spot on there. There's some very interesting research now comparing three generations and on, you know, the boomers and the, what I guess they're called, the Zs and the millennials. And, you know, it when we look back at the 2016 election, the media was completely blindsided by the support that Donald Trump had because, well, they have their values and that's what they talk about and they talk to themselves in their own groupthink. And it seems to me that this is happening again. We have a political establishment that is completely invested in the war in the war machine and in interventionist foreign policy. The media just loves to go along with it. You know, they love war. I mean, that's such a great for their bottom line. And all those beautiful missiles. That was one of the worst moments in television history, in my opinion. But it's happening again. And I think that this is you're seeing such a disconnect here. With public opinion, and if you don't ask them the right question, you're not going to get the right answer, or you'll just completely ignore it, which I don't put past them here. I think there's a growing tension here, and I think this is where Tulsi really taps into it, though I think she'll be obliterated even before the primaries. I mean, the attacks on her are unbelievable. She has flaws in my mind, but every person and every politician does, but I think someone that has that kind of appeal should be given a platform and argue her case. She was on MSNBC and she was plummeted, but she wasn't destroyed, okay? She knows what she's talking about, and she showed the people that were asking her questions that they don't. Go ahead, Daniel.
The lack of respect for that one instance in and of itself is unbelievable from the corporate-controlled media. That's another systemic issue we have. We're not supposed to have protected free speech from media that trades on the stock market and has lobbyists that can influence Congress and vice versa. That's a whole nother conversation. But Tulsi Gabbard wore the uniform, served in Iraq, has the opinion of many, many soldiers that I talk to that are Generation X onto the millennial generation that have served in the Middle East, whether it be Syria, Afghanistan, Iraq, or whatnot. They have a lot of the same opinion, except for they're not allowed to speak it out outside of having a beer with them. But Tulsi represents that generation, that apparatus, that mentality. She's seen combat, she's worn the uniform, and that blatant disrespect and disregard for her opinion from that to being a member of Congress who has traveled to these areas as a member of Congress, received intelligence briefings, and is privy to a lot of information. That example alone speaks to the problem that we have from the media itself, and you'll see her absolutely excoriated by her colleagues as well in her party, as she was in 2016 when she was just a member of Congress in leadership of the party trying to bap Bernie Sanders and allow some of that agenda to come out at that point in time. She was removed, basically forced to resign from being the vice chair of the party at that time. So, you know, the trend continues.
You know, Philip, you worked at the CIA, and I'm sure you keep up with current and former colleagues there, and probably know military personnel as well. I mean, when they look at her candidacy, and I'm not throwing my support behind her, I'm throwing support behind some of her words that I think need definitely to be heard and do certainly resonate with a lot of people. That's why she's controversial. That's why they pile on her, because they want to stifle her. And all of what we've been talking about is also an attack on the right to dissent. And this is what I worry about every single day and touch on every single program I make. Go ahead, Philip.
Yeah, and one thing I would point out that nobody's mentioned up till now was she was incredibly courageous when she made her personal trip to Syria to meet with the leadership there to assess the situation on the ground. That gets her lots of points with the constituency you're referring to, which is former intelligence officers, former military personnel who are knowledgeable of what's going on in the Middle East and in Afghanistan. And I don't know a single one of my former CIA classmates or former Army colleagues who actually supports the current policies that the government is pushing. And most of them are very, very sympathetic to what Tulsi Gabbard is saying. So I think we're seeing a groundswell which the politicians are going to be the last ones to want to recognize. And but if this gains enough momentum, they might have to recognize it. And certainly that's what I am hoping will develop out of this. We need a discussion, a nationwide discussion on America's role in the world. And that is long overdue.
Well, Thomas, it seems to me that Donald Trump should be a little bit worried, because we do have evidence in certain congressional districts that current serving military personnel and veterans found Trump's message of anti-interventionism attractive, and possibly the reason why they voted for him. He could lose that constituency with what Philip said in an article recently, a real anti-war candidate here. What do you think about that Thomas in Washington?
Well, Peter, to be honest, I'm really not so interested in Trump, and I think he's going to lose any which
okay.
way.
No,
Tulsi Gabbard here. She's a very interesting person.
Yes.
I don't think she's got any chance of getting the nomination for a lot of reasons, including her relative inexperience, the fact she comes from a small state. On the other hand, winning isn't everything. She could, in fact, be the most important candidate on the list, to the extent that she gets the conversation changed. Now, I think Bernie Sanders understands what's going on. I don't think Elizabeth Warren does. I read her foreign policy speech at American University, and I don't think she gets it. Now, if Gabbard shows that there are votes here, then those folks will recalibrate and come on board. And that then gets to the important thing. Where are those votes coming from? Well, I think they're actually coming potentially across the sphere. We've talked about the millennials, Gen Xers. They're there already. They are no longer very happy with our economy. The American dream is dead for them, so that they can't be bought off in the way of the past. Then you move up the generations a bit. And Americans are kind people. They don't want to kill people, and nor do they want to get killed. And so they are a little confused. Gabbard begins to unpack their confusion by beginning to make them understand, as one of the speakers said, America's place in the world. That's what it's about. And that begins to tear through some of the propaganda. That begins to tear through some of the military-industrial complex issues. And so I think she's a very important candidate, potentially, perhaps even the most important.
I couldn't agree with you more, Thomas, and I'm glad you interrupted me, okay, because that was very well said. Daniel, one of the things that I really worry about when Tulsi went to Syria and had a meeting with Assad, I thought that was very courageous, and I thought it was something that needed to be done, okay? Because American statecraft and diplomacy, well, what happened to it? It's gone. It's missing in action here. Daniel, what I do worry about is the weaponization of all this, is that if you talk to someone like Assad in Syria, or you think there should be a dialogue with Russia, you are almost portraying your unpatriotic feelings. You're a traitor, treacherous behavior. I mean, it's gotten so extreme that if you voice anything beyond the mandated mainstream, you're considered beyond the pale even to talk to. That is not going to move the needle in the right direction for anyone. Go ahead, Daniel.
Yeah, and that's where I talked about that hopeful optimism of the uptick of involvement in the next election, especially, and we did see it in 2018 from the millennials showing up and turning out to vote, because that is the only thing where a member of Congress, someone in the Senate, or a presidential candidate is going to really hear and feel that pressure and sentiment. That's the opposite of what they're playing to and pandering to the neocon baby boomer generation, that 36% to 40% of the base. That really is the only thing that'll break through the corruptive money that we discussed in the political process, is when they feel that the voters could oust them. Then you'll have more conversations like, should we continue to promulgate the war in Yemen? Should we continue in Syria? Should we continue 18, 19, 20 more years in Afghanistan? And that's it. It's really that public pressure that is the only thing that's going to change this national conversation. And hopefully we'll start to feel that and see that next year when the primary elections, come up on the presidential campaign cycle.
We'll see. Philip, another trend that is going on simultaneously is shutting down dissent on the internet, knocking off websites that have alternative news. It can be either of the left or right, but speech is speech. And we see this concerted effort. The Atlantic Council has already been mentioned. You know, they're an advisor to Facebook. Could you imagine a worst advisor to have? I mean, outsourcing the right to express your opinion to people like that, okay? We're seeing it all over the place. I know a lot of people in alternative media, and they're being throttled, they're being disappeared in broad daylight, they're being demonetized, and from what I understand from people that like to boast about their love of censorship, this is just going to get more and more intense. So we may not have that national conversation because the networks and legacy media certainly doesn't want to have a conversation. Go ahead, Philip.
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. I mean, and the interesting thing about it, of course, is it goes from left to right in political terms, that people are being censored for offering alternative explanations of what's going on, whether it's to the left or to the right, seems to make no difference. It's a bad trend. There was a recent story about Tulsi that some organization, some shadowy organization, was monitoring the internet and discovered that the Russians were very interested in Tulsi and what she was doing.
Yeah, NBC reported that. NBC reported that, yeah.
Yeah, NBC. And then it turned out that Bill Kristol and his gang and an organization called Alliance for Securing Democracy, one of these new think tanks, were the ones behind it. So there's going to be a lot of this. But remember, Tulsi has made as the centerpiece of her campaign the anti-war message. And this is new. This is new in American politics. And since Gene McCarthy anyway, but I, for one, am very interested in seeing.
I, for one, on this program is going to keep on this story here. Gentlemen, we've run out of time. Many thanks to my guests in Washington and in Percival. And thanks to our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. And remember, crosstalk rules.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.